From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
We're here in the budget lockup, and as we all expected, this document is very much pitched at the imminent election. Here to discuss the politics and the economics, I have today Peter Martin, the economics editor of The Conversation, and Tim Kolbach, a writer for Inside Story. Peter, can I start with you? What are the standout features of this budget as far as the ordinary voter is concerned?
A tax cut that goes back in time, Michelle, which is a pretty tricky thing to do, but people are going to get a bigger tax cut at the end of the financial year that's about to end than they expected when it began. They're going to get a rebate of about $1,000 instead of the $500 that was promised. Now, you might say that that's electoral in focus because that's money that'll be going into people's pockets in a matter of weeks, depending how soon they get their tax returns in. But it's probably also economic-based as well, in that in the budget we see that, frankly, the domestic economy, we've got money coming in from mining, but the domestic economy in terms of consumer spending and so on isn't flash. It's interesting to note the size of this bonus that's going to people that's doubled will be about $1,000 for a lot of people in the middle income range. That $1,000, $500 now doubled to roughly $1,000, is more than the Rudd government's first cash splash during the GFC of $800.
So, Tim, do you think that in this budget the government has sacrificed the economic for the political?
No, I think it's actually a fairly modest budget. It's really, given that we're heading right into the election after this week, into the election campaign, it's really quite modest in what it gives. As Peter says, it's given another $500 to people in the near term. But then to wait for a bigger tax, you're going to have to wait till 2022-23. It's well down the track. And the new spending, likewise, it's really fairly restrained. It amounts in net terms to $2 to $3 billion a year in a budget of $500 billion a year. So we're not talking big biggies.
Now, just in terms of the economic outlook, there seem to be two messages: that the economy is fundamentally sound, but there are all sorts of clouds around the place.
Well, I think governments always say the economy is fundamentally sound. I think they were saying that in 1990. And
before the recession we had to
have.
That's
right, yes. As we were going into recession, they were saying the ship is on course. And I think what Peter said is quite right. The economy is not flash, as consumer spending is not flash, and there's reasons to think that the decline in house prices will have an impact on consumer spending. Indeed, Treasury admits that itself in the economic analysis. And so there's good reason for the government to be giving a bit of stimulus to the economy, and what is in its electoral interests and what is in the economy's interests are very nicely in coincidence.
Now, Peter, what about the wages story? We've heard so much about wages recently.
What the government has done in this budget is what it's done in the previous budget, and the budget before that, and the budget before that, which is to assume that wages are going to take off, they're going to increase. The rate at the moment is 2.3%. After a while, it's going to go up to 3%. But they've just, as they've done for I think about five budgets in a row now, they've just pushed out the start date of that improvement. Now, we are seeing a little bit of improvement. Wage growth is slightly higher than it has been. But the future of that is uncertain. Not uncertain if you, as Tim said, not uncertain if you look at the perennially things are okay sort of budget rhetoric, but with the hit to incomes of housing prices, if businesses start thinking that consumer spending is not going to hold up, then you're looking at a situation where suddenly workers won't have whatever bargaining power they've got, and wage growth will in fact weaken or won't get any stronger. So it's the forecasts, as always really, forecast that good times are just around the corner, but there's been scarcely any sign of them. Now, I'm not really blaming the Treasury for forecasting good times around the corner, because in the long run, they say, they have a model. Wage growth has got to...
Assuming things work in the long run.
Yeah, and they assume the long run will happen eventually, right? That wage growth has got to equal inflation, which is around 2%, plus productivity growth, right, which is around 1%. That'll give you 3%. Now, the fact that that hasn't happened hasn't stopped them from believing it will.
Well, I think, can I just register a slight disagreement of tone? Peter does see things in black and white, and I'm more of a grey person. Wage growth is rising very slowly. It is rising, and I think the forecasts this year are more reasonable than in previous years. They're not forecasting it to go back to 3.5% or 3.75%. It's a pretty modest, I think it's only another 0.25% up. They are expecting it to get to 2.5% this year, which may be heroic, this financial year.
It ends up at 3, as it has always ended up at 3.
It was 3.75 at one stage.
The other thing which is good in what they've done is...
In their forecasts,
there's been realism in the forecasts, whether that's come from the Treasury, most probably, or the Treasurer. They could have factored in, the convention would have allowed them to factor in these high iron ore prices we've got. The convention is that you take the previous 4 weeks' iron ore price and assume it will continue for 4 years. They haven't done that. They've assumed, in line with their advice and common sense, that this iron ore price is going to come down as Chinese demand goes away. Now, that's cost the government money in the budget. It didn't need to do that. So I think you would be a brave person to say that the forecasts in totality are anything other than reasonable. You've always got to give them some slack. It's their job. And I don't think you can say that they've done it wrong.
Now, Tim, what are the vulnerabilities of this budget that Labor can home in on?
At first sight, I can't see anything that I would think provides an obvious lever for Labor to hone in on. And as I said, to me, it's a modest budget. I think what's particularly interesting about that, Michelle, is that they have not spent all this money. They have programmed in for a budget surplus next year of $7 billion, and as Peter says, on reasonably conservative and sensible assumptions. And that, for a budget, for a government in a state, electoral state that this government is in, that's I think shows a fair bit of restraint, and it recognises that the debate has shifted, and its people are less likely to be bought by big spending and more likely to be bought by the impression of fiscal reticence and control and delivering a budget surplus. And I think what is particularly interesting is that Labor, remember, took a lot of flack in 2016 because it came out with a budget. Its budget was going to be...
Spending the benefits of the boom.
They were going to have bigger deficits in the short term than the coalition. And this went against their message that in the long term they were better managers. So I wouldn't be surprised if Labor actually targets a higher budget surplus in the next year than this one.
And just finally, Peter, do you think that this will change the conversation for the government?
Will it change the conversation for the government? I think it gives Labor an advantage, and Labor has always had that advantage ever since it announced its action against negative gearing and capital gains tax, ever since it announced its changes to dividend imputation policy. Labor has more money than the government. I don't think it will want to disagree with anything in the budget, but it still has an advantage over the government. Now, there was nothing the government could do to take this away, but what Josh Frydenberg has done is brought down a budget, his first, in which he is unlikely to be embarrassed in the future. Look at Peter Costello's last budget. He gave away money ways that turned out to be unsustainable to seniors and all sorts of people. Seniors got checks just for being old and so on. Josh Frydenberg hasn't done that. He has begun to build a legacy that Peter Costello began to throw away.
Tim Colbatch, Peter Martin, thank you very much. That's all for our Budget Lockup podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Burlage. We'll be back with more interviews later in the week. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.